But welcome. Apparently there are some other things happening on the Hill besides this briefing, something about health care and budgets and things like that. But thanks for coming to this event. Religious hiring is important in its own way, and we're glad that you could join us. I'm Stanley Carlson Tease, president of the Institutional Religious Freedom Alliance. IRFA works with congressional and administrative officials, with the media, and with others to preserve and strengthen the religious freedom that faith-based service organizations need so that they can be both shaped by faith and free to flourish. Considering religion when hiring staff is a common practice among religious organizations. After all, these organizations are organized to do religious things or, very commonly, to be engaged in quote-unquote secular things like education, social services, or healthcare, but in a distinctively religiously inspired and informed way. So naturally, they seek staff committed to their specific religiously grounded mission, just as here on the Hill, congressional offices are careful to select staff based on commitment to perspective, ideology, party, and not just for their general expertise. Yet some activist organizations and a part of the public persist in regarding religious hiring by religious organizations to be simply blatant and wrongful discrimination that has no good justification. In their view, religious hiring simply is wrong and it ought to be illegal. At the very least, it ought to be illegal when government money is involved. They claim that whenever a faith-based organization receives a federal grant or contract, surely it must be illegal for that organization to discriminate on the basis of religion when it hires staff. So, is religious hiring by religious organizations simple bigotry, or is it a basic right? That's the focus of our conversation today. So you have an agenda for the briefing. You can see we've divided the topic into three parts, and all three speakers are now here. So we're happy about that. I'm going to do introductions here at the start, and then we'll each speak for about 10 minutes and then open it up for Q&A. All right? Steve McFarland is Vice President and Chief Legal Officer for World Vision. In the previous administration, he was a director of the Department of Justice's Task Force on Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, and before that, he served among other important roles with the Christian Legal Society. Kim Colby directs the Center for Law and Religious Freedom at the Christian Legal Society, and among her other services, she played a key role in congressional adoption of the Equal Access Act, which protects the freedom of public high school students to meet for prayer and Bible study. She's also involved in defending the rights of religious university student clubs and of religious business owners with moral concerns about required health insurance coverage. You know what that's all about. I'm president and founder of the Institutional Religious Freedom Alliance. I served on the original staff of President Bush's White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. And in the current administration, I served on a task force of President Obama's Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. I'll say that I don't agree with the president's skepticism about religious hiring by religious organizations, but I wanted to stress the very important fact that the president has not moved to curtail that existing freedom, perhaps because of his desire not to drive away so many vital faith-based service organizations from their partnerships with the federal government. So, welcome to this briefing. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to the Speaker's Office and Catherine Haley for arranging this space for us. So, I'm going to start with a little overview of the religious hiring freedom, and then we'll move on to the other two topics. So, what is that hiring freedom? In a sense, this is a very complicated topic. In another way, I think it's relatively simple. So, I want to focus on the main lines and the main principles. But I wanted to start with a discussion that I witnessed in a House office a number of years ago. This discussion was near the start of the Obama administration, and the administration representative was criticizing religious hiring by religious organizations and pointing out the various activist groups that consider themselves supporters of the administration and that are sharp critics of religious hiring. So the member of Congress didn't dismiss the criticism, but he said this: "I find it very interesting that the activist groups you mentioned are just advocacy organizations, but the organizations they're criticizing, the faith-based groups that hire by religion, these groups are the ones actually performing the services. Maybe they regard religious hiring as important to their work of reaching out to neglected and marginalized people. In any case," he said, "he would rather support the organizations doing the work of compassion rather than the advocacy groups from inside the Beltway." Well, of course, there are advocacy groups that support religious hiring, and there are also service organizations, even faith-based ones, that are critical of religious hiring. But I thought his observation was well worth pondering. Faith-based organizations are prominent among the groups that partner with the government to serve the needy, and they're even more prominent among the groups that serve the needy without government support. Many or most of them, to one degree or another, take account of religion when they hire staff. It may be only when they are selecting the top staff, or it could be they're most concerned about religion when they're choosing counselors or teachers, or it could be that they regard religious conviction and faithful conduct to be essential up and down the whole list of staff members. Whatever it is, for all of them, religion's an important consideration when deciding who should join their ranks and help them carry out their mission. That's because their mission is inspired by faith, and the faith typically sets guidelines on how they will go about fulfilling their mission. The faith convictions might result in a social service that is holistic, addressing spiritual needs as well as physical problems. It might dictate that the organization will serve everyone who needs their help, no matter their immigration status. It might mean that workers get less pay and work longer hours. It may mean no referrals for abortions, or that every effort is made to draw into single community the rich as well as the poor. Whatever that faith-inspired mission is, and however that faith shapes that service that's offered, it makes sense that faith-based organizations are concerned about the religious convictions of the employees, concerned about their standards, their passion, their understanding of social ills, and of how best to help other people. These are all, let's call them, normative matters, not merely technical issues, not just questions of skills and experience. For these organizations, religion isn't irrelevant in deciding how to work and who can best do the work, but it is exactly one of the key criteria of a suitable and excellent employee. That's very different than some members of Congress. Now, one of the big debates held a number of years ago on the Hill, here's what one member said. Our debate here about religious hiring, religious discrimination, he said, this is about whether or not people in good faith who walk through the front door, who need a job and have a talent, are going to be chased away because of their religion. That's what this is about. Whether or not a completely well-qualified individual who walks in and asks for a job is going to be turned away just because of their faith. Well, that's a very different perspective than a faith organization takes its faith seriously in structuring how it works, and therefore wants to make sure that everybody it hires is on board. For them, it is exactly one of the qualifications for the job that the person shares their basic convictions. And beyond the qualifications of the employees, I think the organization, no matter how much it draws on government or corporate support, it does count on donations and volunteer help from a community of faith of some kind, and that community, it's going to make a difference to that community whether the staff are people that they can trust along with the organization. The donors trust the organization because of what it stands for and who works for it. That common commitment to a particular religious understanding of the world often draws together the donors and employees and the volunteers into a powerful force for good. That's interesting that the three organizations represented here today believe that religion can be a crucial qualifying characteristic for employment for a faith-based organization, and not just a random thing of trying to keep people out. World Vision, globally active in 100 countries providing development and relief aid, has a clear religious hiring standard, helping it to maintain a staff with a common mind about how best to respond to social need, often in extreme circumstances. And that hiring policy has been upheld by the courts, as we'll hear later. Christian Legal Society often advises faith-based organizations that engage in religious hiring and that regard it as a vital freedom and a vital management practice. The Institutional Religious Freedom Alliance's member organizations and associations are all deeply concerned to preserve this freedom. And the letters that we have sent to Congress and to the administration on the issue draw support from Catholic, Protestant, and Orthodox Jewish leaders and organizations. Fortunately, as with the court cases that World Vision has won, the law is on the side of religious hiring by religious organizations, although there is great pressure to restrict that freedom in various ways. So let me talk about that religious freedom. I want to draw your attention to two items that were at your seat. One is a one-page primer on religious hiring. At the top it says religious hiring freedom. Just imagine, it just takes one page, so it can't be that hard a topic, right? But if you need to know the details, because it's part of your portfolio, we've got the book on religious hiring. Come up afterwards and ask for a copy. So that's one document I wanted to draw your attention to. Another one is a do's and don'ts memo about religious hiring. You're looking at bills and want to do the right thing. That gives you some idea of what to do. Well, what about that religious hiring freedom? Here's the basic story. When Congress, during the Civil Rights era, decided that the federal government must step in and prohibit employment discrimination, it explicitly decided that religious hiring by religious organizations should not be made illegal, but instead should be protected. Congress acknowledged that religious hiring by religious organizations is fundamentally different than religious job discrimination by secular organizations. Religion's relevant to the job performance in the one instance, a religious organization, but irrelevant when the organization is secular. A Baptist church should not have to hire a rabbi simply because a rabbi has had more theological training. Similarly, a religious charity ought to be able to decide for itself if religion is an important qualification for one or all of its staff positions. So, Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, adopted almost exactly 50 years ago, banned employment discrimination on the basis of race, color, sex, religion, and national origin, but had an exemption. Religious organizations could consider religion when hiring employees responsible for quote-unquote religious duties. That was the original language. So right at the start of the federal regulation of employment discrimination, Congress knew that it had to provide protection for the religious hiring practices of religious organizations. But what are religious duties? And who gets to decide, the government or the religious organization? And if it's a government, doesn't that require government officials to intrude deeply into the affairs of religious organizations? Well, Congress was worried about that wrongful government intrusion, so when Congress revisited Title VII in 1972, it created a broader exemption than that original one. Now, religious organizations are free to consider religion when hiring for any position in the organization, not just for people doing quote-unquote religious duties. In this way, as Sam Ervin, the North Carolina Democratic senator and constitutional expert, said, the political hands of Caesar would be taken off the institutions of God where they have no right to be. Because of that religious organization exemption, a religious organization is still banned from considering race, color, sex, national origin, and so on when hiring staff, but is free to make employment decisions based on religion, on the very factor around which the organization is constructed and managed and inspired. So the religious hiring freedom goes back to the beginning to our nation's premier civil rights law. Under federal civil rights law, religious hiring by religious organizations is not illegal or wrong. It is specifically protected. And that protection was unanimously upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1987. We'll hear about that case in a few minutes. It had to do with a janitor at a Mormon health club, and the court unanimously said the religious organization can decide about religious qualifications. I want to stress that this religious organization exemption, Title VII, is different than the ministerial exception that you hear about and that was the subject of a really important court case, and we're going to hear about that court case in a little while. The Title VII religious organization exemption is something that Congress created. I think it's its response to the First Amendment. And it allows a religious organization throughout the organization to decide whether and how far religion is important to making its employment decisions. The ministerial exception is something the courts created. You can think of it as kind of a super exemption that allows, in the case of ministerial positions, clergy and so on, it could be a school teacher in one case, allows in those instances a very radical freedom for the organization to disregard just about any other civil rights law to make hiring decisions. That's what the courts created, has to do with ministerial positions. The Title VII exemption that Congress created applies to all the positions in a religious organization. Well, what happens to religious hiring when federal dollars are involved? Title VII says nothing about government money. Title VI, which does talk about government funds, doesn't mention religion as a forbidden basis of making decisions. So here's the basic picture. The standard or the default position is that religious organizations are free to consider religion when they decide who to hire. If it's awarded a grant or a contract to provide services because of its excellence, what happens then? Well, the organization, of course, can't use that money to pay for religious activities. That's true for secular as well as religious organizations. The organization that gets government money can't discriminate in providing services, but the religious hiring freedom is maintained when the organization gets the money as a general rule. So here are three circumstances. Most commonly, the statutes that govern the federal funds for a particular program or service say nothing about employment discrimination, and therefore the default freedom of religious organizations to hire based on religion is maintained in that program, even though they take the money. There's no restriction put on it. In a few programs, these were all enacted during the Clinton administration and are called charitable choice programs. In those programs, Congress decided to be very explicit about protecting religious hiring and actually wrote into the statutes that the organization does not give up or does not waive its religious hiring right in taking that money. But even if that language is not in a statute, the right doesn't go away just because the organization gets the money. So the first case, silence, the freedom stays. Second case, very explicit. You take this money, you don't give up your religious hiring right. But then third, there are some federal programs, such as the Workforce Investment Act, Child Care Development Block Grant, some SAMHSA programs, Head Start, Violence Against Women Act, juvenile justice programs, and so on. In a number of federal programs, some of them pretty important, there is a specific employment non-discrimination requirement. So in those programs, an organization that takes the money has to agree not to discriminate based on religion and other bases. But I want to stress, and we'll hear more about this in just 2 minutes, in 1993, as you remember, Congress adopted the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, requiring the government not to place a substantial burden on religious exercise unless it has a compelling interest to do so and has no other way to accomplish its purpose. And one consequence of RFRA is that, faced with a religious hiring restriction in a particular program, a religious organization can still take part in that program, potentially, despite the restriction on religious hiring, and it doesn't have to stop the religious hiring. So we'll hear that explained in just a moment. This administration, the previous one, have worked out in detail what that means. There's a way for an organization to apply to have the religious hiring restriction waived. There's an Office of Legal Counsel decision memo upholding that freedom. And so even in the case where the law restricts religious hiring, it may still be possible for an organization that thinks that's an important freedom and practice to take part in that program. So that's a basic introduction. There are a few more details on your one-page hiring primer. Don't forget that other memo about looking at the language in those bills that come across your desk. Stop there. Steve.
Good afternoon. How y'all doing? I was in Olympia, Washington 2 weeks ago tomorrow, and I was testifying for the State Senate Law and Justice Committee. And they're considering a RFRA, a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, to be passed in that state. It would be the 19th state in the union to have such a law. And as you know, 20 years ago, this November, Congress almost unanimously passed a federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And one of the state senators, at the end of my testimony, she said, why should religious organizations always win over other civil liberties? I mean, won't this bill, just put the thumb of the government on the scales of justice so that religious exemptions always win? And I said, no, categorically no. If I say my religion requires me to engage in child sacrifice, do I get an exemption from the Washington State homicide law? No. Why is that? Because there is a compelling government interest in having no exceptions to the homicide law, and I'm all for that. Doesn't matter if that's the central sacrament of my faith, it doesn't matter. There are some things where religion will lose, always does lose. What RFRA does, just to be very clear here, is it says that the government better have a darn good reason for not allowing any religious exceptions. Okay? This doesn't blast a huge hole in an act of Congress or a state legislature. It simply says for this party, because of their religious nature and their convictions, that would be substantially burdened by not getting an exception here. We don't find a compelling reason why they can't. What's an example? Supreme Court in 73, and the Yoder case, 72, said, you know what, the Amish, we're going to allow them to have their kids opt out of mandatory high school because within their culture, that's enough education, and this is a time immemorial belief on their part. The desire, the substantial government interest in having universal education bowed to the higher value in that case, in that community, for a religious exemption. And this explains why RFRA passed in a democratically controlled Congress and was signed by a Democrat president who later said that his signature on RFRA was one of the greatest accomplishments of his administration. And now, when's the last time you ever heard of any civil rights bill passing almost unanimously by Congress? Well, basically you're talking about RFRA. And now why is that? It's because it is restoring, as the name suggests, restoring the way the law was prior to a ill-advised Supreme Court decision in 1990. That's why everybody from the ACLU and People for the American Way to the Southern Baptist Convention and Christian Legal Society, National Association of Evangelicals, and everybody in between all came together, an extraordinary coalition. And I just want to be clear that it simply says, if you're going to say no exceptions to this law, you better have a really good reason. National defense, child protection, domestic abuse elimination, what have you. But the first freedom of the First Amendment is a pretty important interest as well. And it's a limitation on government. Why does the government not like religious exemptions? Because it's inconvenient for bureaucrats. It's just kind of a bother to have to consider somebody's conscience. But you know what? The first freedom of the First Amendment, as a matter of fact, the whole Bill of Rights last time I checked, is a limitation on the government. It's inconvenient for the government. It's inconvenient for police to have to knock before they kick the door in. But you know what? That's the Fourth Amendment. It can be messy, and we're not asking for exceptions to the Fourth Amendment, but we're asking for a consideration of religious conscience, and in this case, about how a faith-based organization can stay faith-based through its hiring. It just stands to reason. If I went to Nancy Pelosi's office and asked and applied for a job, she'd have every right to ask me about my protected thoughts and speech and convictions of a political nature. And she'd have every right to say, I don't agree with your political ideology, so you can't work here. My tax dollars pay her salary. What do you mean I can't work? Because she is trying to have a staff that shares her mission. So this is not rocket science. So World Vision wants to have a maintain. Yesterday was its 63rd birthday. World Vision was founded in 1950. We want to have everybody pulling in the same direction for the same reason. So we ask, do you profess Orthodox Christianity? Doesn't matter if you're Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant, what have you. But is the Apostles' Creed expressive of your deepest conviction? And we have a right to do that, thanks be to God, through, as Stanley has said, the Title VII of the 64th Civil Rights Act. Now, I want to mention that there, it should be common sense that there shouldn't be any carve-outs or sacred cows in weighing in applying this standard of a compelling interest. And unfortunately, on this hill, there's a tendency to sometimes want to do that. And on both sides of the aisle, what I mean is, on a half a dozen times, well-meaning friends or others will introduce a bill, and they'll say, notwithstanding any federal law to the contrary, this is going to be the rule. Well, implicitly, you have just ruled out RFRA by saying, notwithstanding any other federal law. That's not a good idea, because that whatever the interest is in that bill, you just said it's preeminent. It trumps the Bill of Rights. It trumps everything. Well, let's think twice about that. So, examples of exemptions that we've gone to, those of us remaining in the coalition, we'll go to these folks and say, sponsors, and say, understand why you don't want to have the Religious Freedom Restoration Act apply. For example, there's a bill called the Bereaved Consumers Bill of Rights Act, and this was a well-meaning act to apply to religious cemeteries, apply to all cemeteries, and what they needed to do and what they couldn't do. And they wanted it to apply to all cemeteries, and they were just overlooking the fact that actually most cemeteries are religious in nature and are sitting on religious ground. So, religiously owned ground. So, but they specifically said, and RFRA will not apply here. So we just went to them and said, if the interest in having full disclosure to bereaved people who are trying to buy caskets and buy plots in the ground, we understand that's very important, but it doesn't trump religious freedom and Congress. That's why Congress passed this law. So they just lined it out. But if you'd make it easier on us, just keep in mind you don't want to have any of that language about notwithstanding any federal law to the contrary. And you especially don't want to have a list of bills that are lined out, like in the recent immigration bill, not the one that was passed, but in earlier iteration of it, it said because somebody didn't want to have any Indian territory along the border, an American Indian be able to say, you're putting a fence you're putting a fence and a minefield through our sacred ground here, and we'd like you to think twice about that under RFRA. Well, let's think twice about it. Let's not have a blanket, we're steamrolling any RFRA claim. So. Those are some attacks, so to speak. Those are some inadvertent or intentional attacks on religious hiring rights by carving holes into RFRA. And once you start with one, pretty soon it's going to look like Swiss cheese. Finally, Stanley mentioned in passing that there is a Department of Justice opinion, which you ought to be aware of. It's still good, still there. Now, what do we care about the Office of Legal Counsel and the DOJ? Well, it is the lawyer for the entire federal government, the executive branch. The OLC, the Office of Legal Counsel, tells is the authoritative voice for what the law means for 2 million civilian employees, innumerable defense employees, and a $1 trillion budget. So it's very important. And in June 30 of 2007, and that's where you'll find it, the easiest way to find it, go on to DOJ and under Office of Legal Counsel, June 30, 2007, there is a legal opinion with my employer's name in, mentioned in it. This World Vision said, hold it, we have been receiving federal funds by competitive bids, and we've won a number of federal grants, and we continue to exercise our Title VII right to consider religion in hiring. And one of the grants that we won was a DOJ grant, which was of the category that Stanley described, where they explicitly say no discrimination in hiring. So who wins? RFRA says we get an exception. The Authorizing Act says you don't discriminate. The authoritative branch of the Department of Justice, with, and this opinion remains until it's withdrawn, it says that under, depending on the circumstances, and in the case of World Vision, because of our religious nature and identity, RFRA does apply, and it trumps even the explicit ban on discrimination in an authorizing statute. So that's an important point, and to the credit of this administration, it has not withdrawn that. At least last time I checked, it hasn't revised it, it hasn't criticized it. So, but the point is, it could. The Attorney General could withdraw that anytime. So that's why we need to not have things rest on an administrative opinion letter, but have things rely on an explicit act of Congress, whether it's Title VII or Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and an act of state law, State Religious Freedom Restoration Act in 18 and hopefully 19 states. Thanks.
I hope you can hear me. Is that all right? I've been given far too much to cover by the men. And so I just want to hit things quickly because we do want time for question and answer, and I know your lunch hour's almost up. But if I could do one thing on this issue, I would help people get a new mindset about it, because we keep talking about discriminate, and our country has a very bad history with racial discrimination, of course, and other forms of discrimination. And so we've come to the point, and this is usually a very good thing, that when someone says discrimination, we go, oh, that's horrible, that's bad. But what's happening is we're seeing discrimination applied to things that are not horrible or bad, they're First Amendment rights. And it's particularly, we're seeing this increasingly in the last few years about religious liberty. Because really what we're talking about up here when we say discriminate on the basis of religion in hiring people for religious organizations, what we're really talking about is the right of a religious group to be religious. We see this on some campuses. Some of you are probably familiar with it, where Christian groups are being kicked off campus because they have leadership requirements for their leaders. They want their leaders to be Christian. And we're seeing this in the employment setting, where increasingly, as Stanley and Steve have outlined, there's pressure on religious groups that we're being told that we discriminate and therefore we can't participate in different government programs. And what we need to do is get the mindset that yes, discrimination is bad. Non-discrimination laws are very good things. But for 50 years, Our experience with non-discrimination laws, both at the federal and the state level, have basically been, not always, but basically been that those laws prohibit, they are robust laws prohibiting discrimination, but they almost always include what we call an exemption for religious hiring practices, for religious groups to be religious. And it's really important for us not to kind of say we want to discriminate. We want to have our religious liberty to be religious so that our society continues to be a pluralistic society and one that respects the First Amendment. So that's the main thing I want to say. Fortunately, one of your handouts is a lengthy article by Professor Rick Garnett, but he's trying to put this in academic terms of why discrimination on the basis of religion for religious groups is not wrongful discrimination. So it's a very helpful article in thinking through these issues and in your work. But also a helpful source is the opinion that Stanley was referring to that the Supreme Court came down with last year, 2012. It was a unanimous decision. It's called Hosanna Tabor. And I also included it in your handouts because it's a very readable decision by the court. Again, it was 9-0. And in that case, it was whether churches and church schools have the right to determine who will teach their faith and convey their message, or whether that right is trumped by federal non-discrimination laws. And the court, 9-0, and I think everyone was shocked that it was unanimous, said that even non-discrimination laws have to give way in certain circumstances to religious liberty. I was going to read several excellent quotes from that opinion, but I'll leave that to another day. But basically, I'll just read two, because I think they're important that you know that they're in there. And one is that the Department of Justice was arguing that non-discrimination trumps religious liberty. Indeed, the Department of Justice was arguing there was no protection in the free exercise and establishment clauses for religious organizations to determine who their ministers and teachers would be. And the court rejected that as untenable, stressing that the text of the First Amendment itself gives special solicitude to the rights of religious organizations. The court rejected the government's, quote, remarkable view that the religion clauses have nothing to say about a religious organization's freedom to select its own ministers. Justices Alito and Kagan went together on a concurring opinion that went even farther in saying that, yes, non-discrimination laws are good things, but it's easy to forget that the autonomy of religious groups, both here in the U.S. and abroad, has often served as a shield against oppressive civil laws, and therefore we need to protect religious liberty. So we have this really great recent ruling by the Supreme Court. We have the ruling in 1987 that upheld Title VII's constitutionality, that has a lot of really good language by Justices Brennan and Marshall about the importance of religious groups having the right to hire according to their religious beliefs. And then there was this recent decision involving World Vision where the Ninth Circuit got it right, which doesn't always happen. And the Ninth Circuit said that World Vision was a religious employer for purposes of Title VII and could require its employees to agree with its religious beliefs. The other thing I've been asked to do, and then we'll go to Q&A, is to just briefly note that one of the problem that you have to be nuanced and sophisticated in dealing with religious liberty in the non-discrimination context means that when non-discrimination laws are working their way through Congress, it's important that we make sure that the religious exemption in that law is as robust as possible. And so, as most of you probably know, The Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which has been introduced back in 1995, recently was sent out of committee over on the Senate side. It has a religious exemption that tracks part of Title VII, so that's a good thing. It doesn't track all of Title VII, and one of the improvements that we would recommend be made is that it include a BFOQ protection like Title VII does, which it currently doesn't. Another protection that we would like to see explicit in any non-discrimination law would be what Steve was talking about, that is say explicitly that this law does not create a compelling government interest for purposes of trumping either the First Amendment or the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And we think that language, we need to start getting in the habit of explicitly putting that language in any non-discrimination law. Finally, and there's on one of your handouts, I think Stanley gave you all of this information's there, so I'm not going to go into any more detail, but the main other provision that needs to start being in any non-discrimination laws is that religious groups that exercise their right to hire according to their religious beliefs will not be retaliated against. And one of the reasons this is necessary is in a slightly different context. The California State Legislature this summer, the Senate passed a law that was going to punish the Boy Scouts and religious groups and other youth organizations that held traditional values on matters of sexual conduct. And it was going to take away certain tax exemptions under state law from that group. It passed the Senate. It stalled in the Assembly. But I think it's a good example of what we're concerned about. And so we would, we have specific language in your handout about adding anti-retaliation language to INDA or any other non-discrimination law that just makes it clear that not only can the organization hire on the basis of their beliefs, but they can't be punished for doing that by being excluded from federal programs or from tax exemption and that type of thing.
Great.